Shopify grows your business no matter how far or big you grow. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. Whether you're selling your fans' next favorite shirt or an exclusive piece of podcast merch, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/income, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/income now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in.
Osiris.
Welcome to Wheels Off, a show about the messy reality of the creative life. I'm Rhett Miller. That's when it got wheels off. Started up and we ain't gonna stop. Oh, she made me feel like a god. That's when it got wheels off. Alan Paul is an author and a musician. His life has wound up centering around the guitar, as he was the managing editor of Guitar World magazine for years. He plays guitar in a band called Woody Allen, spelled differently, that he formed in Beijing, China, when he lived over there. Wrote a book about that, a memoir about his experience, finding acclaim in the world of rock and roll in China. He has written a number of books, most recently a biography of the Allman Brothers. And he is a badass in the world of journalism, music journalism, and guitar writing. I didn't quite know what to expect. He is not the most obvious candidate for a Wheels Off interview, but I'm so glad that I spoke to Alan about his experience in these two worlds. And I think what we wound up with is a conversation that has a lot of really, really useful advice and wisdom about a life spent as a creative person, a creative life. And there are a lot of different paths, you know, and the thing that I think that you will find in this interview, the thing that struck me the most is the idea that sometimes there's a lot of value in flexibility in your life. I mean, certainly in your art as you're making it moment by moment, but in your life when you're making the bigger decisions that you look back on that sort of determined the trajectory of your life. I think there's a lot to be said for going with the flow, for accepting alternate routes that you might not have envisioned to begin with. Anyway, I think Alan brings a lot of unexpected, certainly by me at least, wisdom to this conversation, this ongoing Wheels Off conversation about how to live a creative life. I'm really glad I got to speak with him, and I think you're really going to enjoy listening to this episode of Wheels Off. Please welcome Alan Paul. Welcome to Wheels Off, Alan Paul. Thank you so much for joining me. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, Rhett. Thank you. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Of course. For the edification of our listeners, from where are you logging in?
I'm logging in from my home in Maplewood, New Jersey.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. Other side of New York as you, I think.
I know. I've got friends in Maplewood. That's a fun little town full of bands. In fact,
full of musicians, writers, photographers, journalists, et cetera.
Nice. Well, congrats on the new book.
Thank you very much.
That's so exciting. How long have you been working on this one?
Well, sort of like forever.
Yeah.
actively about 2 years, which I guess doesn't include the last year of sort of wrapping it up and having turned it in and waiting for it to come out. So almost 3 years really since I started working on it.
It's funny. I always talk about this with people awaiting the release of albums, but it's similarly true of authors. Is that period of having something in the can but unreleased, is that nerve-wracking?
It's a little bit less nerve-wracking now because this is my fourth book, but so a little bit less so every time. But it is, and it can be frustrating and annoying. And you know, years ago, long before I was writing books or recording music myself, I was interviewing musicians, and you know, like you, mostly for Guitar World, but for many others as well. And so many musicians would say to me, you know, I'd be excited about a song or a guitar part or something, and they'd say, oh yeah, oh yeah, oh God, I can barely listen to that anymore. I wish I had done this or that. And I understood it intellectually, but I didn't really get it until I started, you know, doing more longer term creative work myself, including, you know, recording an album and but more to the point, these books. That is something that can be interesting. Even when the book comes out and you do an interview, somebody will seize on something they really like. And of course, all you should say is thank you very much. But it's really hard not to think, oh my God, that's that paragraph that should have been a chapter, and I blew this and I missed that interview. Or, you know, you hear and know all the flaws that nobody else does. So during this period is when you sometimes reflect on those things and then try to move past them.
Since this has been in the can for so long, do you have another creative project that you're working on now?
No, yes and no. I mean, I always have a few things I'm working on, but I'm not definitively working on anything. My very first book, Big in China, was a memoir about spending 4 years, 3.5 years in China with my family and forming a blues band with Chinese guys and touring. And it's a fascinating book to me. I mean, it's obviously close to me because it's the only one that's about me and my life and my perceptions rather than a biography of others. And so much has changed since it came out, and I have more perspective. So I've gotten the rights back to that, and I've been slowly working on an updated and expanded version of that. I actually was before I started on this, which had a time element. So, planning on going into that more full time, but who knows? I thought that before this one. So anything's possible.
Doing the research before I talked to you, I noticed that the film rights had been sold at one point for that. Is that something that you thought might really happen? Did you ever work on a screenplay yourself?
Yeah, so that's Big in China was optioned by Ivan Reitman, who has since passed away in just the last few years, and his Montecito Productions. I did think it might happen. I mean, anyone who's ever written or known people who write books know that it's pretty common for things to get optioned and nothing ever happens. In fact, that used to be even more common when there was more money flying around and they would just option everything they could think of. And so I was totally aware of that when I made the deal. But he was a guy who usually tended to buy one or two things at a time and actually work on them. So there was a lot of progress made. I signed away the right to work on the screenplay for better or worse. I went for the money. My attitude at the time was, it's probably not going to happen anyhow. I'd rather get the most money I can. Yeah. Just being really honest, nobody ever talks about the commercial aspects of art, but I had three young kids then and, a tenuous artistic existence. And, honestly, that money has helped pay for my three kids to go through college. So I don't have any regrets about that. And in fact, that is what happened. It never got made. I got pretty uncomfortable with the screenplay they were working on, but it made it to the point of being pre-production, and the studio rejected the screenplay, and then the whole thing just fell apart.
Oh no! Did they just take too many liberties and made it crazy in the name of
Hollywood? Yeah, basically, and it was like 80% accurate right up to the point where they took wild liberties, which in a way made me more uncomfortable. If it had just been, you know, completely fictional from the start, I could have had much more plausible deniability to make people believe it wasn't real. But it's okay. So, I still think it's a great story. And, I'd love to see it ever have a cinematic life, just because I think it's a valuable story. We didn't realize at the time, I mean, there was no way to realize that we were actually in China during this absolutely golden age. We thought that things were opening up. I say we, I'm really speaking about the broader community of expats and journalists. And there were always naysayers, and they really turned out to be more right. I have to say, because most of us really felt that it was this golden era right before things were just about to open up, and China was going to just become, much different. And it turned out we were actually at the peak of openness, not the beginning of the opening. So, the perspective I have now is that we really were very, very lucky to be where we were when we were with who we were with.
And what an incredible experience to be able to be, a musician and, highly regarded, get to do big shows and stuff.
Yeah, thank you. And well, to be honest, even more so than that is, I certainly had played guitar for a long time, but I was much more of like a basement jammer or get up and play at parties, sitting with friends, bands. I mean, I had certainly been on stage, but not as the front person, and not as even playing, not as my own band touring. And I never would have done that if I hadn't been in China. It was really just a chance meeting with this incredible slide guitar, lap steel player named Woody Wu. And he, we jammed one time and he was encouraging. He was really great. I mean, he is really great. He could come in here and play with you guys. I hear tracks all the time I could be at Peach Festival and hear someone and be like, God, if these guys had Woody on lap steel, they would really blow up. He's a fantastic musician. And the fact that he liked my playing and singing and encouraged me is the only reason I did that. And so I've been back from China for almost 15 years now, 14 years, and I've performed, hundreds of gigs since then. And never would have done any of that if I hadn't been there and had that experience. I think I probably would have remained a party jammer, not a gigging musician. So, it opened up a whole new world for me. And I think, I still never stopped considering writing to be my primary vocation and skill. But I do think I'm able to talk and write to and write about musicians much, much better now, having spent so much time touring, gigging, and then to some extent touring. And so then with my band Friends of the Brothers over the years, we've stepped it up a notch. And now I've played festivals. I've served as the tour manager, the manager, the booking agent. We do have an agent now, which I'm happy about, but I have done all those things. And sometimes they're horrible to have to do. But I do feel like I have a more of a 360 and realistic version of, a musician's life now, which is helpful.
It's so funny that your career as an author has been so guitar centric, right? That's a fair assessment, right?
Yes.
I wonder when you were first envisioning how your, as a kid, how your adult life might unfold, did you imagine that you would be a musician? Did you imagine that you'd be an author? Both?
Epiphany moment? That's a good question. I mean, probably an author, yes. A musician, no. Mostly because I always have loved music and was drawn to music. I had a lot of friends in high school who were musicians. And I made the mistake pretty early, like certainly by late in high school and early in college, of thinking, gee, it's too bad I never like became a musician instead of, because, it would have been the easiest thing in the world to get a guitar and say to my friends, teach me a G chord, and then see, which is what I eventually did. But I mean, I could have done it much earlier. And so I guess I sort of thought, oh, well, that ship has sailed. But I always was around, starting in college, I started playing a bit. And when I was 24, I was hired as the managing editor of Guitar World, which was, thanks to Brad Talinsky, who also is the guy who gave me the idea essentially for this book, Brothers and Sisters. So Brad has remained a great friend and inspiration and friend, mentor, everything for decades. He hired me really out of the blue. I was just giving up because I had just struggled so much for 3 years. I think the year before I had made like $10,000 and, was doing all kinds of odd jobs. And I just thought, well, I gave this a writing thing a whirl, didn't quite work out. I was applying to graduate school to become a teacher and figured I would keep, writing on the side. Brad just, it was a lot of work that went into how that, Brad discovered, found me and everything, but, he just hired me to change my life. I never thought that guitar would be, I was very, very insecure about my guitar knowledge when I started at Guitar World. I would have thought it would come more from, you know, Rolling Stone, or when I was younger, like Cream or Crawdaddy, which were no longer viable when I was starting a career. But that was more the angle I was coming from. But Brad's attitude at that point was they had too many guitar people and they needed literary people who were attuned to music. I mean, I did play guitar. I did have, you know, I had been around bands. I knew, I wasn't completely oblivious at all. But I wasn't a real guitar guy the way everyone else there was. But that's what made me so insecure. And so I bought some new gear and took lessons for the first time, real lessons, instead of just a friend like teaching me some things, and improved. You know, that was, I still was terrible. You know, even as I started to be okay, there were so many people at Guitar World who were incredible players that I was still really insecure about. You know, I didn't want to play in front of people. You know, those people anyhow. Oh, yeah. I would go to my, it's hard to overcome that, you know. It's like being the little brother, you know, no matter what you grow up to, you're still the little brother when you're with your big brother. It was that type of thing.
But you brought writing chops like nobody else, and you can learn technical stuff about guitars.
Yeah, and that was Brad's genius, you know. Guitar World for years had been sort of like the third rate guitar magazine, because Guitar Player was the granddaddy that invented it, and they were still really good, and they were more serious players. And then Guitar for the Practicing Musician was coming around then, and they were growing because they were pretty weak editorially, but they had transcriptions. They pioneered that, and so they started grabbing that audience. So Brad became the editor. He had this vision to triangulate the whole thing, like, let's raise our editorial standards so that we're like Rolling Stone caliber journalism. Let's do transcriptions. Let's do them, find the best transcribers and hire them, do them better than Guitar Practicing Musician. And we'll do the tech stuff and the lesson stuff, but we'll keep it separate, like sidebars from the Rolling Stone caliber. That was the goal. Editorial. And he switched over to doing mostly Q&As instead of prose, initially out of frustration because the caliber writers he had to deal with wasn't good enough, he felt, to write the articles that he wanted. So he thought, well, if we just get a Q&A, you know, if we can just get people to do good interviews, and it became sort of our featured trait. And then, you know, we all worked together. So it was great. You know, it was like I mentioned about China being there at the right place at the right time. I feel like with Guitar World, I was just there at the right place at the right time. Really exciting time in guitar and rock and roll and in journalism, still magazine journalism. So I've been really fortunate on these things to just, you know, keep my antenna, my eyes open and my antenna up, and just be lucky about right place, right time.
I feel like if anybody that I talk to that's managed to eke out a career in a creative field, claims to have been very lucky, but I think there's a lot of work that sets you up to be lucky. Probably.
Yeah, thank you. Absolutely. I mean, that's definitely true. I prefer the word fortunate sometimes.
Yeah. Lucky,
because lucky is like finding a $20 bill. You didn't like necessarily do anything. I definitely worked hard and I worked at my craft and I was good and all that stuff. But still, you need to have the good fortune of the right people, the right time, the right place. And for me, as it turned out, the right wife. You know, my wife had a stable job. You know, I was at Guitar World for years, but when I left there full time and went freelance, I had the cushion with having kids of having a wife who had benefits. Another thing I think people don't talk about honestly enough, but, you know, I mean, geez, how many musicians do you know with that same story? Most of them in my world, and probably,
yeah,
you know, that's fine. That's cool. You know, God bless them. And, you know, those of us who are good, you know, good, I think we provide our own, you know, we help take care of things too. It's not like we're whatever, schnors, to use the Yiddish word, but you know what I mean.
So you described your early 20s pre the Guitar World opportunity arriving, and the sort of wrestling with what you're going to do and are you going to go to grad school? And I imagine that, you know, as you've described a career that's bounced between a few different things and a few different large projects, there must have been times when you suffered anxiety, for instance, or maybe you had a lot of doubt about, you know, your whether or not you were doing the right thing. Maybe you had negative voices in your head telling you that you weren't good enough or that it wasn't going to work. Everybody I've ever spoken to about this stuff, you know, has admitted to having some sort of internally generated obstacles that they've had to overcome. And I wonder, in your case, what secrets have you figured out to get past those?
Well, that's a good question. So first, just the first word you used is anxiety. And I have so many friends and relatives who have, you know, actual clinical anxiety. And of course, it's so common. And I don't have that. So that is the first thing. That's not a secret. It's just that, again, it's just luck. You know, that's genetics. I mean, I don't think it's a weakness or a strength or anything. It's just, again, that's really good luck. Now, having said that, of course, there's periods of anxiety in the broader sense. I just wanted to separate the two. It's like saying you're depressed. I mean, we all go through periods of like that, but it's not clinical depression. I've just seen too many close people to me suffer with clinical anxiety and depression that I want to be really like clear about that. That again, is just good fortune. You know, it's really tough. Partly self-confidence that sometimes is misplaced, and you can go pretty far down a road, and that's where the real anxiety can set in, where you go, why was I so confident this was going to work out? I'm down a blind alley. But just to take a little broader thing, it's similar to a question about people always ask if I get really nervous writing books or hit writer's block. And how you deal with that. And it's the same thing in a broader thing. Of course you do. The only way it gets easier to me is a little bit of confidence that it will work out. Because the first, you know, each time you hit this thing where you're down a dark alley and you go, oh my God, I've got 9 weeks left. And this thing that I thought was about to pay off is a bust. And I got to like backtrack and delete these 100 pages or whatever. That still happens. I'm a little less on this book actually, but the anxiety of, oh my God, I'm dead, and it gets better. And I feel the same with the broader picture. You know, my wife has had this big career, and I've gotten a lot of kudos for supporting her. But the truth of it is, every time I did something that seemed like a big sacrifice for her and her career, over a period, sometimes quickly, sometimes over a few year period, it paid off, and it ended up being this like great opportunity for me. So after a few of those, I started to have a little faith, like this will be okay. I mean, one was I moved to Florida with her when we were just dating. I had a job my first year out of college at a little newspaper in Hoboken. That had ended. I had a part-time job offer in Putnam, New York. She had a job in Tampa, and I just said, oh, hell with it, finally. She was my girlfriend. She wasn't, we were serious, obviously, but it's not like we were engaged or anything. And I just went down there. It was tough at times, but it ended up being this incredible experience for us. We've had this great marriage that's so important to me and everything else I've done. And because I struggled, I didn't make much money, but living was really cheap, and I really honed my craft as a writer. And that, just as I was giving up through after some other stuff, led to the Guitar World thing. Then after 5 years at Guitar World, 6 years almost as the managing editor, she got a job at the Wall Street Journal, but it was in Detroit. And I quit my job and moved there. But I was getting really burned out on being the managing editor. And I was looking for other editor magazine jobs. And if I had gotten one of those, I think I would have hated it and burned out after a couple of years. So I just had more time to write. So again, I devoted myself to writing. Then when I was getting like, you know, early 2000s, I had three little kids, and I was just like, my wife now has this career at the Wall Street Journal, and I'm still writing for Guitar World. And I was sort of like, oh, I'm interviewing Warren Haynes for like the 100th time. Like, really? Shouldn't I be doing something else now? But that was like this brief interlude. Eventually, the relationships I built with people like Warren from interviewing them so many times, you know, that paid off and led to all this other stuff. It's hard for me to believe that I ever resented that. But there was a period where I was just like, felt really, really stalled. And I was cranking stuff out. And And then the China, the big one, I quit, you know, I had a staff writer job at Guitar World and Slam Magazine. I quit them both to move to China for my wife's job. And that opened up like this whole new world for me, not only the music that we discussed, but I wrote a column about living as an expat. I covered the Olympics for NBC Sports. So I did all these things. And again, each of these came after like, and I got all these kudos for like sacrificing for my wife, which is, I think, just like a form of sexism, because the women never really get that if they sacrifice for their man. And I had these huge payoffs. So I don't know. It's just kind of keeping faith. It's easy to look back and see a lot of places where you could have gone, you know, off the road, but didn't. So that then it's just being thankful.
It's funny, listening to you talk about this, it reminds me of the way in music that's, you know, primarily kind of jam based, where people are playing off of each other in the moment and creating parts as they play. It sort of makes me think of the way that you're approaching these big decisions in your life. It's kind of like that. It's as if you're taking what comes to you and rolling with it and making the best out of that, and not having some predetermined idea of how it has to go, and then being really strict about following that, making everybody else, you know, follow your vision. Does that seem fair?
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, that's a really good summary. I like that. Thank you. I didn't really frame it that way, but it reminded me, you know, when I started playing with the Chinese musicians. So the original guy was Woody Wu. We went through a few different rhythm sections, and once we got a little better, a little more serious, Woody brought in this guy, a bass player named Zhang Yang, a drummer Lu Wei, they're incredible musicians. I mean, again, these guys could come here and drop into almost any band and change the nature of the rhythm section, they're excellent. What they didn't really know how to do was play in the moment and improvise. And they certainly were capable of it. It's just that they thought of that as something that happens in jazz. All of them had, especially John Young, the bass player, had played a fair amount of jazz and was very well acquainted with the concept of improvisation, but not in a sort of pop, rock, blues song structure. It took me a while to realize that, because we were first were just really jammy, and you know, we chose, but then when we sort of realized we had something, we started rehearsing and we really put arrangements on songs, you know, have some beginnings, ends, breakdowns, all, you know, arrangement. And then slowly started writing original music. After those initial shows like that, Woody was sort of, you know, we had pulled off this show at the biggest venue we had played yet, and I thought it was great. And we're packing up, and Woody seemed kind of down. And I said, "Hey, man, we did it." You know, it's just. And he said, "Yeah, but like we're sort of like lacking something now. It feels a little stiff, you know." And I said, "Yeah, because Woody, we were like we had this like appeal that people liked because we were just like playing off each other, pulled people in, but it was sloppy and things would fall apart. And now we've tightened it up." Now that we've tightened it up, we have to loosen it back up so that we get that we can do it. And I realized that they didn't conceptually understand that. I really had a hard time explaining that. I came from such a background with the Allman Brothers, the Grateful Dead, and many other bands, offshoots of that. I mean, you could, you know, the Burrito Brothers, anyone, you know, you could think of a million bands that we all know, the band who are going to play like that. So, I burned them some Allman Brothers CDs and brought it in, and some Grateful Dead, I think. And then I just, you know, and we would do the arrangements as when we were starting to write songs too. They'd say, you know, how long are you going to solo here? And I said, well, let's set the normal at 24 bars. But, you know, if you're not feeling it at 12, you know, just put your guitar neck up and get out. If you're feeling it at 18 and you want to keep going, you know, give a little signal and go 36, go 48, take it, you know, swap them back and forth. And at first they were like, yeah, but how long should it be? You know, and they took to it, I mean, beautifully, but it was amazing to me. That was, again, part of my insecurity of like that, you know, I'm not, you know, they're such better musicians than me, so I need to just like try to keep up, which was sort of true initially. But then I realized I have so much I can teach them. And then that's when it really became a band. And it was incredible to be able to, I don't know how to explain it. Like that was one of the incredible things about playing music there and with those guys. You know, there would be no opportunity in America then, you know, to find like guys in their 30s who are that good and well-versed in this kind of music who have never heard the Allman Brothers. You know, you might not like them, you may not be influenced by them, but never heard them. They realize that it's like, oh my God, okay, this is like a tabula rasa. I can, and it was incredible. And they had great musical taste and sort of great musical knowledge, but it was random. Like they would know certain songs and really like them. But, you know, I view the world through this, like, you know, music critics, Rolling Stone, encyclopedia of rock thing of, you know, who came from what. I mean, you know, you had the Hourglass and you had the Allman Brothers. They were influenced by Muddy Waters. Muddy Waters also influenced the Rolling Stones. And, you know, I see my world in these family tree charts. And these guys just heard songs and liked them, but they had no context. And, you know, it was fascinating, really, really fascinating. That's when it became sort of a beautiful relationship. And I have tried, I guess, you know, I hadn't really thought of my whole life in that realm the way you framed it, but I certainly thought of that part of my life in that realm, and it does sort of make sense, and maybe that's why I've been able to relate to this music and these musicians, is it just as an approach it makes sense to me.
Yeah, I think there's something so beautiful about the way musicians approach life, because, you know, the instinct is so important in to a musician, right? Like, what's the next note? What's the next lyric? What's the next, you know, movement in the arrangement? And I've noticed in, you know, so many of my friends who are musicians, in their lives, they tend to be more likely to follow their instincts and make brave choices or stupid choices or choices that other people, more uptight, straight world people, might not make.
Yeah, and it's interesting when you do that as a parent to try to raise. That's why I could write a whole other book about that. It is interesting. Like, you know, you teach your kids somewhat when they're little to be skeptical of the man, you know, and then eventually they get to be adolescents, and, you know, you realize you're the man.
Yeah,
you raise them to rebel against you to find that happy medium.
You played yourself. So I wonder, because you've got such a unique perspective on this, having been in a band and playing as a musician with other people, and also having written books by yourself. I mean, and obviously when you're writing biography, there's a collaborative element with all of your sources and your, but you've also written books as a collaborator. I wonder, what is it like to write as a collaborator versus make music as a collaborator? Does that make sense?
Yeah. Well, some of the same skills are required, but it's very different, because writing music as a collaborator, and for me, in my experience, usually comes on the fly. Even when you do then stop, pause, and it becomes the arrangement. And obviously there's an element of really like breaking it down and playing something over and over. But for me, the way the collaboration usually works best is on the fly. And then you codify it. That's what works for me. Writing a book as a collaborator is much more moment by moment, brick by brick. In some ways, more excruciating. But there is a similarity for sure, which is just the concept that something can be really personal to you, but you still don't have total ownership of it, and it can be better with someone else's input, and you have to be open to that. That can be a hurdle in either front. The book you're talking about is Texas Flood. This is my CIA biography that I co-wrote with Andy Allidort. And Andy has been a friend and colleague from Guitar World for, you know, 30 years. And we play in Friends of the Brothers together. We sort of founded it together. So we've collaborated on a lot. Andy is stubborn as a mule, as he'll readily admit. So we butt heads, but also we do have decades of friendship behind it, and so we know, like, we can say things to each other, you know, that you know if you and I started working on a book after we had gotten to know each other, I mean, I'd be more careful with you, because until I got to know you, I know what I can say to Andy without offending him, and vice versa, and when, you know, we can get mad at each other and make up. But It's hard to collaborate on a book. The upside of it, aside from, is it's just better and it's less lonely. I mean, writing a book is a very intensely solo activity generally, even though you do, of course, talk to a lot of people and you, as you're writing it, that's, you know, you asked before about the anxiety and the insecurity. The biggest part of that for me is the first part where like, I mean, it depends on the book, but let's just say roughly like the first 100 pages you write, you get into a groove, you know, you're very insecure at the very beginning for sure. But that's like baby insecurity. Cause it, you know, that's just nervousness. Then you start writing and you get into a groove. You feel really good about it. This for me anyhow, I'll go, okay, I got it. I got the voice. I got the storyline here and you feel great. And you invest months into something. I don't generally want to show it to anyone until I'm pretty, I have established the voice and the tempo and like where it's going to be. Then when you're waiting for feedback from someone reading it, that's where that's the most anxiety and insecurities come in, because during that period, you start to think, wait a second, what if he comes back and says he doesn't like it? I'm in trouble here. And that hasn't, you know, luckily really happened to me. But Brad Tolinsky, again, from my friend from Guitar World, gave the first, I think, 6-7 chapters of Brothers and Sisters a read. And he was really encouraging, but he saw one big hole, something that was missing. It was extremely helpful. He was hesitant to bring it up, but he said to me, do you want me to be really honest? And I said, yes. And it was just missing some background information that he pointed out. And once he said that, it made total sense to me. And there's a brief moment of, oh, no, I've got all this more work to do. But then once you go back and add, for me, this section, it made everything else work. And so it was a great suggestion. The upside, like I said, is writing a book can be really lonely. So when you're collaborating, it's almost like you have a copy editor going along with you. And even though we would sometimes disagree and fight over whether something should be included or not, and sometimes each of us won at various points and took things out, but it also, it took away some of that insecurity, because by the time you finish something, another person had already read it, you've already fought over it, and you've made a decision. So that was a big upside to it, actually.
Well, that's funny. So yeah, from the different kinds of collaboration with a co-writer and then with these kids that we raise, I wonder if you'd be willing to try and distill some of this wisdom, like imagine a 21-year-old version of yourself, but in 2023. What advice do you think you might want to give this younger version of yourself?
Well, one was the thing that I sort of stumbled on with the musicians in China, which I mentioned, which was be tight but loose. And you could apply, I mean, obviously in music that has a really, I think, pretty easily understandable meaning, which is be tight, like be well rehearsed, be know the songs, know the riffs, be in sync, and be loose enough to like let it go where it wants to go on any given night. And I think that sort of applies to life. I mean, you can't just completely improv your way through life. The handful of people we all know who do that are legends, right? And you talk about them and sometimes it comes out great and sometimes they walk off a cliff, but we all remember those people because it's kind of a wild way to live. So I think you need to have some structure and practice, be good at your chops, you know, like practice your chops, whether it's writing or music. Or just interpersonal relations. I mean, you have to like work at it. You know, you have to like constantly have yourself in therapy to some extent. You don't have to literally be in therapy, although I think that's wonderful. If you have the time and money to do it, it's a great thing. But I mean, really like just to be self-analytical and just be, but also to always be practicing. There's really no fast track. So I think you have to be bold enough to leap at your chances and humble enough to just keep your head down and keep grinding. That's one of the great things that I felt I benefited from coming up at Guitar World. We were really, really scrappy. You know, we didn't get like the cover story with Keith Richards handed to us. We had to like ingratiate ourselves to people. And eventually we did start getting stuff Through the front door because we established ourselves. But we were really guerrilla and we were really hardworking. We had a passion for it. So I think nose to the grindstone is really good. And I don't know, you got to be a little willing to take your lumps.
And I love that. I don't think anybody's put it that succinctly, but of course you would as the writer that you are. But brave enough to leap at chances and humble enough to keep your nose to the grindstone. That's great.
Yeah, thank you. I just said that on the fly. Like I said, I'm best off the cuff. Oh. But yeah, that is sort of how I feel. I don't know. You know, I'm from Pittsburgh. I went to public schools in Pittsburgh, and it's sort of who I am. And I don't know. You know, that's something my wife and I have had a lot of. We have certain differences in our approach to careers and lives, but she's from Bay City, Michigan, and she, you know, neither of us, as we've had various amounts of success and stuff in New York, we've always felt a little like interlopers, and we don't take anything for granted, and we just work hard and try to have each other's backs. And that's the same thing with just friends and colleagues that you trust and respect, bandmates, whoever. I think that's another important thing. I would give it that advice to myself or to anyone is look for the, what was Mr. Rogers' advice? Look for the friendly people or something, you know?
Look for the helpers.
Yeah, look for the helpers. I mean, hey, he had it. I grew up in Mr. Rogers' actual neighborhood in Pittsburgh, by the way. But I think that's it. Look for the helpers. I mentioned Brad Talinsky several times. I mean, we have had each other's backs for decades and we've helped each other. I've helped him with a few books. He's been huge in my career. And there's been a few other people like that, Andy Allidort. I mean, we've had a multi-decade friendship and career, and we've helped each other. I mean, these things are not one-sided. And sometimes you're there for them. Sometimes they're there for you. And trust your instincts and also trust your trustees, your trusted people. Does that make sense?
Totally. Oh my God. Yeah, this is great, Alan. I feel like there's so much useful stuff in this conversation that we've had. I really think people are going to love it. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you. And thanks for your podcast. I appreciate what you're doing and exploring this sort of creative mind and how to make it into a life in various forms is certainly obviously of interest to me, but I think it's valuable to a lot of people. So thank you.
I love it. Well, it's funny. I took the Guitar World format. I just let the voice of the artist do all the work.
And then thank you. But you have to ask the right questions. I mean, I know both sides of that one. So
nice. All right. Thanks so much, man.
Yeah, thank you. I really appreciate it.
All right. Thank you so much for listening to Wheels Off. Please be sure to rate and review the show on iTunes. That helps us appear higher in the search results and lets other folks know that it's a cool podcast to listen to. Also, as the kids say, don't forget to subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or anywhere else that you listen to shows like this so that you never miss an episode. This has been Wheels Off, and I'm Rhett Miller, encouraging you to create every day. Thanks, y'all.
Osiris. Hey, what's up? This is Blake Weiland. I'm the host of the Tone Mob Podcast. It's a show where I interview guitar people about guitar stuff. We talk about their pedals, their amps, their accessories, their preferences, all that stuff, as well as a healthy dose of whatever comes up. Topics have ranged from aliens to addiction and anywhere in between. Oh yeah, and pizza. We're definitely going to be talking about pizza. So get the show wherever you're listening to this podcast at. Just search The Tone Mob in your search bar and it will pop right up. Come join us. We're having a lot of fun. Thanks for checking it out.